Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Welcome to Space Junk. My name is Annie Hanmer, and I research space law and international space cooperation at the Sydney University School of History and Philosophy of Science. Part two of my conversation with visiting NASA Sagan Fellow and exoplanet studying astrophysicist Dr. Ben Pope is a lot like a Jane Austen novel. We unpack our prejudice against the Humanity Star and Musk's Space Tesla. We spend a lot of time talking about money and the elite, and ultimately find common ground in our mutual embarrassment about Australia's obsession with STEM. We hope you enjoy this wild ride through politics, philosophy, sociology, and stolen bickies.
All right, so New Zealand has a space agency, and earlier this year they launched a Humanity Star. The Humanity Star being essentially a meter diameter disco ball, which was deavering its way through space. The idea was that you would look up and you would see this star and you would be reminded of the shared humanity of everyone on Earth, which is a lovely idea, except that it's one star out of billions of stars that you can see. And added to that, it got in the way of some
Did it? Well, so I was quoted in, I forget which newspaper, for my little Twitter rant about how I hated it.
I quoted you, your Twitter rant, in a talk I gave.
Oh, good, good. I mean, I hated it immediately. On reflection, it's not that bad. I mean, it could have gotten in the way of astronomy. I'm not aware of any instances in which it did.
Yeah.
It could have, become space debris. It didn't.
Well, it was specifically designed not to.
Yeah.
So it was designed to burn up within, I think it was 9 months. And in the end, it did within like 2 months. And weirdly enough, I spoke to someone who works at the New Zealand Space Agency at this conference. And she was saying that actually the Humanity Star was never really meant to be this artistic humanity thing. Mm. They just wanted to prove that they had launch capabilities and they had to launch something.
Mm.
And they thought, oh, okay, well, we want it to burn up quickly and we want it to be these dimensions and we want it to roughly look like this. And what resulted was the Humanity Star. Yeah. And then they were like, oh, well, we'll create a role for it.
What I didn't like about it was that it was unilateral, that people, by and large, were unaware of this launch plan, and that while it didn't interrupt any astronomy, the idea of sending a bright twinkling thing into space is intrinsically risky to astronomy, to at least a low level. People presented this as if there was nothing else to be inspired by looking into space. You know, look at the ISS. Even Iridium satellites are pretty cool, but the ISS, there's people living on that, and it's really bright. You can see satellites all the time if you're in a dark place and you know how to look. So I wasn't impressed by that, but I just guess the unilateral, we didn't clear it with anyone, didn't really think about what this could have been. Sputnik is just a little thing that blinks in the radio. It's not that different. But the whole idea was that you advertise this as a proof that you can do it, and put some scientific equipment on it. Like anyone would have loved to have had a CubeSat, you know, put into orbit. But no, I mean, look, I don't mind the Humanity Star. I just think it's a waste. I just think it's a waste of a perfectly good launch. And it was done by people who I'm sure had very good intentions, but didn't really talk to the rest of the community who'd got concerns and also had better ideas.
Ben, could I challenge you for a minute?
Yeah.
And suggest that maybe the reason that we don't like the Humanity Star, and I say we because I personally saw it go up and thought, oh, God, what have we done? That we don't like the Humanity Star because it is, in its appearance, a purely aesthetic, artistic, humanities-based thing.
Oh.
In the domain which has previously been reserved for science. You know, previously science was the gatekeeper. Like, science, through national agencies, were the gatekeepers to space access because it was incredibly expensive and difficult. And then now space is suddenly open. It's open because you've got companies like SpaceX where if you've got a spare $30 to $60 million, you can send whatever you want into space. And funny story, I used to work in an investment bank, and one of my managers there was, my ex-managers, I should say, was quite amused by the Humanity Star launch and by Tesla, the Elon Musk Tesla launch.
Yeah,
which is the same deal, right?
I hated that.
Well, we'll get to it. But he was saying, well, hang on, this car's in space. What if I got together with some mates and we sent a bunch of golf balls up into space and launched them in the direction of this car and did some damage? How much would it cost me? And so I did the maths for him, and he figured out that he and his mates could afford it. And there was a serious discussion. Not really. It wasn't super serious. But if wealthy individuals with some backing can afford to do something like that as a lark, or if a billionaire can afford to put his car into space, the gates are broken, right? And so I feel that perhaps there is a sense that the scientific community is feeling threatened and is feeling like their gatekeeper role in regards to space is threatened. And so the Humanity Star is hated because it's an arts thing in a science world.
I think you're right.
Really?
I think...
I was prepared to be shot down.
That doesn't make me recant my dislike of the Humanity Star or the Tesla in space, which I loathed. And I think you're right that to a large extent, the frustration comes with someone from outside the community that's used to dealing with space, coming as an interloper after... norms have been established of what kinds of things go in space after what kind of really very stringent, you know, public discussion. Public, not in the public eye, really, but in terms of in the scientific community, open discussion and peer review and all sorts of things about allocating funding, which is very scarce. I think that to a large extent, what really frustrates me is the ways in which the scientific community's norms have been violated. Now, whether this is because it's an arts thing, I'm not sure. I fully agree that it's because it comes from outside the mainstream of the scientific community. But I think the reason that the Tesla is dicky is not because it's an arts thing.
But it is a commerce thing.
It is a commerce thing. And I think that the Tesla is dicky because it is gauche. The Tesla is dicky because it reads like an advertisement.
Sure.
Because, you know, to a large extent, Tesla is as large as a good space telescope, and they could quite easily have launched a good space telescope. But suppose they didn't want to. Suppose they wanted to launch a beautiful artwork into space. Maybe that would have been good. But they didn't. They launched one man's vanity into space. And I think to a large extent with the Humanity Star, it's not like the Tesla, but it's got a family resemblance in the sense that it had the ring of a vanity project that wasn't public. even though they said it was for the public, there was no public consultation, and it quite easily could have caused difficulty to precisely the people who are most used to that environment.
To push back, Ben,
yeah,
there's no public consultation when people put CubeSats or... Well, for some of them, there are. There are voting things. But for most of scientific projects, there's no public consultation. There's consultation of a community of scientists, perhaps.
I think there's a delegated authority that, you know, if the Australian Research Council wants to pay for a CubeSat that's been developed through a competitive process, that to a large extent, is that this is a public good that has been agreed upon through, like, normal channels. I think the issue is whether there's channels.
Well, if the New Zealand Space Agency approves the launch of the Humanity Star...
The bloody Kiwis.
I mean, they went through a stringent process.
I know, look, but this is why I wasn't rigorously, like...
I'm playing devil's advocate here.
But I think it just... It's aesthetically bad.
Aesthetically bad because it... I think... Because it contradicts norms. Is that what we're saying?
I think to some extent it's because it contradicts norms. But to some extent it... Because it contradicts... Like, not, I mean, like, by that, I mean, in a narrow sense, like, political, economic norms of, like, space is reserved for approved space agencies conducting scientific missions. But I think, if you were going to put, if you're going to put Michelangelo's David in space or something, you know, that'd be cool.
Mm.
I mean, don't. I'm happy with it being in Florence.
You can just imagine it getting blasted by a cloud of space debris on, like, day two.
But if the idea is to put a beautiful thing in space, which sort of has, I'm not the aesthetics police, but, like, which has some kind of dignity to it, that's much better than putting some car in space. Even if it weren't an advertisement, even if he put a Mercedes in space just to prove how selfless he was, that he wasn't even attached to his own brand, I'd still hate it. I'd still hate it because...
Well, but, it's commercialising what has been a scientific domain. And I want to talk a little bit more explicitly about norms because... Mm. So I love norms as a concept, but sometimes if you don't specify, it can become a lot like the word problematic, which I hate. I hate when people say something's problematic because what they mean is there's something wrong here, but I'm too lazy to actually unpack what's wrong. So in terms of norms, are you talking about Merton's norms of scientific behavior?
I'm so ignorant, I don't even know that term.
Okay, so history and philosophy of science being my background.
Mm.
Merton was, I suppose we should say, a sociologist of science or probably a historian of scientists, actually, who in the 40s published a work basically saying that, okay, science is defined by norms and they fall into the acronym KUDOS, so communism or... communalism, as they renamed it, after all of that happened. So communism, universalism, disinterestedness, and organized skepticism. So the idea is science...
Sounds good to me.
Science is like, you share things, like anyone can do science. Mm. You don't have particular financial or social interests in what you're reporting is true.
Mm.
And organized skepticism is around, like, we all sit around a table and we look at your work on its merits and we say, let's try and disprove it rather than let's try and support it. Merton's norms are really what define the cartoon scientist.
Mm.
And a lot of work in sociology of science post-1940 have been to say, no. So Mitroff was a student of Merton and came up with counter norms. So basically the idea was, well, for every norm, there's a counter norm. So you can say there's disinterestedness, but there's also interestedness. As in, when you actually do science, scientists are interested in the sense that they're interested in the results, studying. Yeah, they're rewarded. Like, they get paid, they get tenure, blah, blah, blah. Sort of what we've discussed before. And then more recently, people have said, well, no, science is sort of a socially constructed thing and there's nothing inherent about science that makes it different and, all of those things. So For the record, I do not subscribe to the Mertonian view of science, just in case any HPS nerds are listening.
Yeah.
But I think what you're talking about is you're basically saying there's this Mertonian ideal of science, which is communism, universalism, disinterestedness, and organized skepticism, that makes science special. And commercialism, or what we might sort of say vanity or an advertisement or any of those things, or art fall outside of that. But art, we can put a little bit closer to it because we could say, well, you know, there's something universal about art. So maybe it kind of fits in a little bit better. But commercialism is definitely on the outer. Does that sort of describe what you were thinking about when you were talking about
Norse? Yeah, no, I think so. You've expressed it much better than I ever could.
Well, I did study it.
Yeah, no,
whereas
it would
you
make
had
sense.
To make do with a scrappy astrophysics degree and a PhD from Oxford. So
I know,
you know,
I'm
fair enough.
Barely educated, but I think, I mean, I'm well aware that society is, science has always existed in society, and I'm very fascinated by, you know, these figures such as Robert Oppenheimer or Wernher von Braun, or indeed Henrietta Lacks, who exposed the ways in which society and its politics, not necessarily use the word infect science, because they've been there since day zero, but in which they encroach upon the ways in which scientists see themselves, in John Fowle's words, as a self-questioning ethical elite.
Self-questioning ethical elite.
Absolutely. You know, the idea is that science, you know, as in the Mertonian laws, but that science should instantiate some kind of utopian society within a society.
Right. Okay.
And I'm well aware that there's no ethical astronomy under capitalism. You know, there's no ethical consumption, there's no ethical industry, there's no ethical astronomy. We've always got the spectre of dual-use technology. We've always got the fact that because we live into capitalism, even if there were no, you know, dual-use technology being funded, just to get things into space would require, you know, the expertise of people whose aerospace technologies are dual-use, you know.
Well, dual-use is a nonsense as well.
Yeah.
I mean, anything is
dual-use.
Anything
can be useful.
As I often use as an example in talks, my shoe is dual-use. It can be beautiful and be on my foot, or I can hurl it at you, and then it's actually a kinetic missile weapon.
Yeah,
you know, and like suddenly that's very scary. So,
I often think about a similarly important character who you've probably heard of, Norbert Wiener, really the pioneer of cybernetics during and in the decades after World War II. Norbert Wiener. Sort of in many ways an intellectual ancestor of some of the things I used in my PhD, not merely cybernetics as a whole, but specifically an algorithm that's the subject of the most interesting story about Norbert Wiener. So he invented a kind of automatic aiming mechanism for anti-aircraft weapons, where suppose you've got radar looking at an aircraft. Well, the aircraft's moving. So if you're shooting it where it is, it's going to be gone by the time the, you know, the bullets get there.
Yep.
So you need to predict its position. So you need to have some kind of analog computer that will project its current trajectory forward and aim it there. But you're a human, so you're, you know, you have to have something in your gun sight. So there's a compensator mechanism that adjusts where the weapon is pointing relative to your gun sight, so that you can be aiming at a plane over there, but the gun sight's going to be there.
Yep.
That I recognise that the amount of pointing that I just did was awful for a podcast, and I apologise to any
Look,
of our listeners.
Our listeners surely have imaginations.
Any of them. But the algorithm that he developed for this computer became the Wiener filter, which is the first example. Well, okay, that's a lie. But it's the first good example of a Gaussian process, which is a wide family of algorithms currently popular in machine learning and ones which I relied upon in parts of my PhD. And so, you know, this is of really great significance. You know, he really, like, invented a sledgehammer to crack a nut. He pioneered powerful and deep mathematics in order to do quite a... It's not a simple problem, but he realized that it's a very hard problem that you had to solve with a very hard method, even though it sounds like, oh, you just project it forward a bit, right? When you add noise, you have to have ways of statistically getting that up.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the Wiener filter, very important. And he developed this in an explicitly military context. After the war, he had written this paper on the Wiener filter, and a military engineer, some years later, asked him for a copy of the paper. And he had a huge dummy spit. And he wrote to a journal, and he said, I will no longer... You know, it's actually quite a long... quite a long sort of essay level thing that he wrote as a letter to this journal, which they published in full. It's called, I want to say, A Scientist Rebels, is what it was actually published independently as. He wrote to the journal, spitting the dummy massively in a long and angry letter. But the gist of it was that he would no longer provide copies of this paper to military scientists. He would provide copies to anybody else, but not the military.
Hmm.
And he said, I developed this in a military context in a time where I believed it was necessary because of the evils of Nazism. I now think that in the present context, the escalation of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union is evil, and that people who make weapons for either military are threatening world peace. And therefore, I don't want my work to be any part of it. You know, go and invent it yourselves. But I'm not going to have anything to do with it. I will refuse to even issue copies of my publications to people with a military or military-adjacent affiliation. Which I think is very interesting. I think this is actually really good from a certain perspective when you look historically at how commodification and weaponization as... two sides of the same coin, of seeing things in very reductively practical terms for the needs of the powerful, is something that you never get to go back on. How, Lewis Mumford was talking all about how the Industrial Revolution was not really a revolution just of steam engines, but of clocks.
Hmm.
Of people having the idea to commodify time itself was fundamentally the intellectual project of the Industrial Revolution. You know, and we didn't get that back. People today talk about how they'd like to have a 9-to-5 job as if this is the norm, if that is how people work. And that's what's good. And millennials are really having this trouble because there's no 9-to-5 jobs that will pay to live.
Yeah.
But as David Graeber talks about, 9-to-5 jobs are a massive historical aberration. People did work. They did work that would add up to the results that they needed historically.
Mm.
And in very few societies, not none, but few, until the Industrial Revolution, would anyone sell their time, per se, as the norm. We don't get this back. And so I think a lot of the idea is you've got these ideas of how space or time or fundamental aspects of our world are organized with or without commodification and with or without instrumentalization for the needs of the powerful. And once they're instrumentalized for the needs of the powerful, you never get them back. And that's why I have a really zealous attitude towards space.
I want to return to this idea of ethics and where ethics fit within science.
Mm.
To have a discussion about... You spoke about the fetishization of technology.
Mm.
So I'd like to, if I may, bring this conversation around a little bit to talk about Australia's newfound obsession with innovation.
Oh, for God.
And with STEM. Mm. So this idea that what we need to be doing is science, technology, engineering, and maths.
Yeah.
And that is what we all need to be focusing on learning, because that is how we will all... get great jobs and earn enough money to buy avocados and houses.
Mm.
And and that as a nation we need to be innovating by using disruptive technologies and so on and so forth. Of course, this, like the E in STEM doesn't stand for ethics.
No, right? No, maybe it should. Maybe that should be maybe your rebrand. Should.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sociology of technology and I've always thought ethics and morals and...
Hey, doesn't good. Quite please, work, does please it? Please do that.
Yeah, it doesn't quite work, but we'll work on it. We'll workshop this. But please, tell me... Well, I know a little bit about what you think about STEM.
I hate STEM.
I would like to talk about it. Go on.
No, please, go on.
No.
I hate STEM.
Tell me why.
STEM is... look at society, right? How many people work in manufacturing in Australia? Depends on what you count as a manufacturing industry.
Sure.
But maybe 10 or 20% at most. And that's being quite generous at the 20% end.
Yeah. I'd say that's pretty generous.
I'm really including all of the aspects of, software development and high technology industries. Most of the economy is a service sector. Historically, that's been maybe 20% of the economy. If you exclude administrative services and really, restrict it to hairdressing and waiting and so forth, it still is about 20% of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people work in public or private administration. It's really the largest single sector of employment. Nearly all of them don't need for their work to know about the structure of the atom. They just don't. I mean, if you might need to know a bit of maths, but frankly, the level of maths that you need to do your average administrative job is not, full unit HSC, let alone university. Now, I'm not saying they shouldn't learn science, but the idea that your scientific education is predicated on the employment needs of a society which structurally doesn't actually need that many scientists and engineers in the way that it's currently organised. And I disagree with that too. I mean, I'm quite openly, depends what you want to call me, but, a social democrat or a socialist if I've had two beers. I'm of the view that, organising society for the private profit of a small number of people is a pretty dumb way to do things. And maybe in a better society, we would actually arrange for a lot more people who are interested in doing so to be working in science, technology, engineering, or maths, which are really good and useful things for society. Building bridges and, programming computers, designing robots. These are all awesome things.
Mm.
It's also awesome to expand human knowledge. I like looking at stars. Some people say, when will you get a real job? And I'm like, it is a real job. The public pays me to do a specified service, which is learning about stars and communicating these results to other people. Whether they think it's a real job, what they think a real job has to involve is some kind of misery. It has to involve some kind of drudgery for someone else's private benefit. They don't want to be able to just be giving money to people like me, who will apparently fart ass around doing a job that looks interesting. And when they produce results, this will be everybody's. No one will profit directly, and people will go, oh, that was interesting. And every so often people will go, oh, that was interesting. I think we can make a better product because of it.
Mm.
But the fantasy of STEM is really, in some senses, the exclusion of the humanities ideologically.
Right.
The idea that you can say we need to have an education policy that prioritises STEM for employment. Well, it's not for employment. It's clearly not for employment. Otherwise, we'd be paying scientists more and we'd have more of them. Well, we're not doing that. And I'd like that we did that. And maybe we should have a STEM policy for employment in which we then go all the way through the stack and actually employ more postdocs for all the PhD students who graduate and then employ more faculty and have, government research institutions to produce new research that'll be products that'll benefit society. But we don't do that.
Mm.
We don't need everyone to be a scientist. I think they should be scientists because it's interesting and beautiful. But the whole point of STEM education is to say, no, you've got to learn how to do practical things with your science. As if we're all going to become nuclear engineers or something. Well, we're not.
Well, it's actually even more than that. It's saying, like, there have been a lot of ads on buses recently being like, you know, with sort of jazzy young women saying, I chose to study mathematics so I could become a robotic engineer and make robots for hospitals. Like, that's the kind of progression. So it's not even about becoming a scientist.
Yeah.
It's about becoming someone who invents technologies or uses technologies in existing ways. So there's got to be a really clear link to some existing job, which actually precludes a lot of science, technology, engineering and maths, which is theoretical. Like, you could be a theoretical physicist and that will pay off, but it may pay off for society in 50 years' time.
But I think a lot of this talk about, you know, how it would be inspiring to be, you know, working in robotics or, you know, this idea of innovation, all of this language is to do with tech startups, and tech startups are sexy. And you walk down campus and there's always someone having coffee pitching their latest startup idea to use, you know, Bitcoin for milk. I don't know, you know, just... you know, whatever they're doing. And, you know, good luck to them. But the idea that this needs to be a nation of innovators where everyone has to innovate their jobs. I mean, look, sure. I mean, there's this Osborne and Frey paper a couple of years ago about how AI is going to kill all employment. And I do think we actually should really worry about large-scale employment issues. But, you know, so you know, I acknowledge all of the main points that are being made, and I'm not going to try and take down all of society or whatever. But I think there's this idea that we have to aspire to be the kinds of people who are rich. You know, there's this, you know, Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and even Warren Buffett are all seen as inspiring people. Bill Gates, you know, they're inspiring. You should want to be the sort of person who has a tech startup, because look at what you can be if you have a tech startup. You can be powerful. This is just propaganda to say that the powerful deserve it. Because you're not going to start a tech startup. And if you do, you're going to fail, because they all fail.
Yeah.
A tiny proportion of them succeed. What you're really saying to people is that we value as a society the people who are the richest.
Well, it's a very dangerous notion, isn't it? Because you say, and this is something that bothers me more when I was working in the US. But there's a sense that if you work hard and you sacrifice, then you can be successful and you can succeed. And success in this sense is monetary or power or whatever the case is. And so the counterpoint to that is if you are not successful, by which we mean wealthy, then you have not worked hard. You must not have worked hard enough. And I think that's very dangerous because loads of people work hard in the conventional sense at their jobs and don't make lots of money because their jobs don't pay very much.
Yeah.
And loads of people work hard in other senses through, you know, maybe they work in science and they think about sciencey stuff and they don't make lots of money. And it's a sense of that.
Yeah.
And so what you're then saying is if you say, oh, well, there's a great opportunity in the tech industry. Everyone can do STEM and everyone can sit in their basement and code something magical and make millions and millions of dollars. What you're saying is basically we don't have to, as a society, as a government, invest in young people and their education and their careers, because all of them have exactly the same opportunity to be entrepreneurs and make billions of dollars. And if they haven't done that, then there's something that they haven't done.
Yeah.
It's not our responsibility. And I find that dangerous, I think.
I think you're absolutely right. I think actually the I forget the phrasing that you used, but you sort of implied it was about the elite mentality of, you know, what things you're providing. And I think that's absolutely true, is that to the elite who might be in government or in the echelons of business or education that make decisions, to the elite, this is their lived experience because opportunity is provided to them to succeed. And, you know, there's cushions for their risks. And so, you know, these sort of neoliberal ideologies of like, the sort of Thatcherite idea of Reaganite idea of wealth creation as being something that entrepreneurs do. This is just self-congratulation. I mean, all entrepreneurs, apart from, you know, a very, very select few, I'll maybe admit, who, you know, invent very useful algorithms that are just widely applicable or whatever like that, you know. But let's, basically, what they do is they find a market and then they get a product and they exploit the labor of lots of people to make lots of that product. And they leverage existing capital from finance to do so.
Mm.
They're not wealth creators. They're at the best wealth facilitators. But the idea is that all of society should be doing this. But they never like to think about the people who, you know, built the product. All the people, you know, labouring away in some Foxconn hellhole where they've got suicide nets or whatever. I mean, wasn't Steve Jobs who made the iPhones?
Yep.
It was poor people slaving away in Foxconn hellholes that did so. But they want to imagine a society without that. They want to imagine a society cleansed, except of the elite, where if you have enough STEM, then everyone's an entrepreneur, and you just don't think about the actual mechanics of labour. It's a mentality of people, and look, I'm one of them, whose educational experience has so divorced them from the experiences of deprivation, risk, and not even just poverty, but of a lack of mobility, that they can't imagine what... They just don't even see that as part of the world.
Mm.
What the world is entrepreneurs who, you know, small business owners at worst and titans of industry at best, who make things themselves, and they don't... They see the people, the employees, as instruments of a will that's from the real people. And they're making policy for the real people, not the little people.
I think, though, the only thing I'd say to that is... So I was very fortunate and went to a very well-off school. You know, and I can justify it all and say, oh, I went on a scholarship and blah, blah, blah. But I did go to that school. And a lot of people I went to school with are now entrepreneurs. So they have started small businesses and become very successful. And one way of looking at it is to say, ah, there must have been something in the education that led to that. Another way to look at that is to say, well, those people are people who have financial backing. And so they can afford to take risks. And they've got the contacts and all of that. And all of that is true. But all I would say is, I think it doesn't negate the achievements of people who have... the fact that someone has a bit of a leg up in comparison to someone else does not mean that their achievement is any less wonderful. But on the other hand, I think what we're saying is we need to be aware of the fact that there are inequalities that exist and that STEM is not a magic wand. You can't wave STEM over every school in New South Wales and suddenly every student has the same opportunities as every other student. It's just absolutely not true. So I think that's one aspect of STEM which we need to be careful of. The other aspect of STEM which I really have issues with is, of course, that personally I come from a humanities background primarily. I have done maths, you know, I speak science sometimes. But I come from a humanities background, but now I work in the space, well, I research and work in the space industry. And so a lot of what I'm coming up against or working with is science driven. And it's very hard to say, like, if you looked at what I do, you'd say, okay, I'm not doing STEM. Even though we might say that history and philosophy of science is, you know, at City Uni, it's in the science faculty. I am not on my in the day-to-day what they think of when they think of STEM. But on the other hand, I think that people who do, people far cleverer than me, like Stephen Freeland, who Professor Stephen Freeland, I should say, who's just stepped down as Dean of UWS Law, but who is one of the world's leading space lawyers, or Donna Lawler for that matter, or, you know, other people who work in space law or people who work in space finance or space design, all areas of what we would call the industry, in scare quotes, they are all necessary.
Absolutely.
And so I really struggle. I was at this conference for the space strategy in Canberra in July, and they had the deputy head of the Japanese space agency attend.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and he gave a fabulous speech in English, which was was very impressive. And then in question time, he had a translator helping, and someone asked a question about STEM and what Japan had done with STEM in their education system, and there was a huge confusion because, of course, the translator was sitting there saying, what is STEM? What's STEM?
Yeah.
And so they had to translate it for her into science, technology, engineering, and maths. And even then it made no sense. And this deputy head of the space agency from Japan was sort of shaking his head and saying, like, well, why these things? Why are we only talking about these things? And in the end, in his response, he made it clear that he thought that... in Japan, they focused on creativity and that science, technology, engineering, and maths were part of it, but only part of it. Mm. And he was very confused at why we were talking about just those things.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a good lesson.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, and a good lesson for Australia, because we think, of course, if we go with STEM, that we'll be on the world stage and we'll be world leaders in STEM. In fact, STEM is... a socially constructed concept.
Absolutely.
Which is a nonsense, really. It means only what we want it to mean, and what we want it to mean makes no sense in the context of countries with established and successful space agencies. And if that doesn't warn us, then I don't know what will. That, you know, actually arts, humanities, ethics, philosophy... are imperative to what ought to be the education that everybody receives in our society, and unfortunately is not currently. But we should be striving. You know, we shouldn't just be saying, "Oh, we need to do STEM." No, no, no. What we're actually talking about is improving the education system as a whole, and a large part of that, of course, will be STEM.
Yeah. But there's this... You're just totally right.
We're in furious agreement here. We should have brought in someone to give a counterpoint. This is...
But in Australia, I think the difference is... Well, I don't know. Maybe in Japan they've got it too, probably. I don't know enough about Japan. We've got this culture war in Australia. People are obsessed with the idea of lefties in education, in indoctrinating children. They are in the States. They are in the UK. About snowflake students, you know, and free speech on campus. And... it's all this big attack, and it's the other prong of the attack on a public understanding of their own society, and science is in that society. I think if you're in a society which doesn't value critical perspectives on STEM, then that's one of the ways in which they devalue, you know, all of the other things too, because then you allow this supremacy of the purely instrumental. And it's not even as if the arts aren't instrumental. You know, people get a lot of pleasure from it, and anything like that should be instrumental. But they're not very useful to people who are powerful and make decisions. They're threatening, because the arts often teach you that people who are powerful are no different from ourselves. Or if they are, they may be worse.
Well, and arts is often the means through which we express dissent.
And we resist through
and
the
we
arts.
Resist. You only have to look at... you can look at anyone like Haydn, Haydn expressed great dissent through his music.
I wonder to some extent whether this goes back to issues like Norbert Wiener. He wasn't a communist. He was probably, I've read his books, he's explicitly not a communist, but he identifies as a Democrat and uses the words in the way that sort of means social Democrat quite clearly. Mm. You know, he argues very forcefully for the welfare state and so forth. So he was firmly on the left in American politics as it stood in the 1950s. You know, well to the left, and faced issues for that. Oppenheimer, on the other hand, he was a commie. They were all communists. You know, all of the generation of the first 20th century of scientists... look, the spectrum of scientific beliefs ran from, okay, there were a few Nazis, but by and large, from soft social democrats through to card-carrying Marxists.
Mm.
You know, all of these people had really firm ideas about society and were grounded in humanities educations. You know, Oppenheimer spoke five languages, two of them classical, you know, and would ride around, you know, Los Alamos on horseback reciting Baudelaire. Okay, he was probably an extreme example.
Right.
But a lot, they all, you know, knew the classics. They all knew, but both in their vernacular and often in Latin. They often had membership of political parties. Their friends were literary figures.
Yep.
You know, this was a milieu in which scientists were part of the educated elite, but not separate from some other part of it, where they all had arts and humanities friends and interests. And a lot of arts and humanities people were interested in science as well. You know?
Oh, and there's a great crossover there. There's a great tradition of crossover between music and science and mathematics.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Tom Lehrer being, of course,
the
best example. Yeah. Gotta love that. Gotta love that guy. Actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tom Lehrer is one of my all-time heroes.
I guess all I'm saying is that there's this history that this is like, this is really ahistorical, even to see it as like, oh, science has always been against the humanities and like trying to crowd it out for educational space, is that for most of its history in early modern through to pre-World War II science, scientists, okay, they may not have been representative of the general population in many ways, and a lot of them weren't very good people.
Mm.
But one thing that they weren't is uncultured.
Mm.
And one thing that everyone would have found inconceivable is the idea that science should be valued more than roundedness of personality and understanding of society and understanding of aesthetics and arts and literature and ethics and compassion and all of these sorts of things that I think we rightly value in a person. There's been some great intellectual project to devalue in that subset of people who are scientists.
Mm.
And that seems weird to me. And I'm not a historian of science, and you'll probably tell me I'm wrong and I'm reading something into this, but this seems to me to be a fundamentally reactionary thing in relation to the Cold War, that they freaked out when, you know, you had nuclear spies and when you had people wanting to be independent thinkers who were also part of an industrial military complex that the whole superstructure of society relied on for its continued existence. They had to be disciplined. And the arts teaches you the opposite of being disciplined.
Mm.
It teaches you to be open. I think fundamentally that's the basis of the STEM dichotomy that shouldn't be there, is the idea that you should be closed and you should do what you're told and, you know, you should value things that are tangible, but not value things that are intangible. That's my... Oh, look, you know, you've heard my lefty rants before, but...
Usually with significantly more alcohol on board than we currently have, I would say. Although we have had some good bickies, so that probably...
Those are good biscuits. I don't know, what do you think? Is that a valid historical perspective or me just ranting?
Oh, I wouldn't like to make that a dichotomy.
Too many dichotomies here.
I think you can be correct and you can rant. I probably don't know enough about Cold War scientific history to be able to comment on that from a historian.
I can guarantee you I don't.
From a history of science perspective. From what I have studied, I think that makes perfect sense. Mm. And I think it's completely valid. Whether it's correct, I'm sure people can argue, but without speaking for all historians of science, I would say that makes perfect sense. I would say, though, that going back to what we were discussing at the very beginning of this segment on the humanity star and the symbolism of that and the issue of having something purely, you know, like just with no scientific value, something that provoked debate, whizzing around the earth, in what had been a scientific domain. I like that in that context. And I think, personally, that it's very important that when we do science, that people like you, who are scientists and mathematicians and so on, are willing to accept, like, are willing to put forward a view of science as something that is not distinct from everything else. And I think often what we get is this thing of, I mean, it goes back to agnotology, which is sort of the study of the social construction of doubt, which you could trace back to anti-smoking and the kind of intentional creation of doubt in science with the use of think tanks as it pertains to smoking and the instance of cancer. And basically, there's this doubt in science. And the reaction from scientists and people in the scientific community when people say, oh, but, you know, maybe global warming isn't true, is often to kind of close in, to close ranks and to close up and say, well, it is true because we've done all this science and this is how science works. And if you don't get it, then you don't, like, you know, that's not valid, actually. We are correct, and this is the body of knowledge we have, and we've done it in this way, and look at all the norms we're upholding, like those Mertonian norms we were discussing. That may be correct and justified, and I'm not for a second denying climate science before anyone gets really excited. Not for a second. But I think there may be something in that, that perhaps science needs to... perhaps in response to this STEM push, in fact, open up. And not just, you know, people talk about STEAM, sticking arts in the middle of STEM. And I think that's even more of a nonsense, because really what we want to talk about is being open-minded, being educated, not expressing that tall poppy syndrome, which happens in Australia, engaging in intellectual debate. Now, but that at the same time, what I struggle with is that that doesn't mean that you can just sort of question facts and make an individual responsible for answering them, as we often see happening on Twitter, like almost constantly. It's like, oh, but can you prove it? Things like that, right? That's not helpful. But ideally, if everyone has a kind of a broad education, which covers off a lot of stuff, and we're all coming from the same direction, I don't think that scientists and science should be afraid of stepping outside the STEM zone and engaging on other levels, be it philosophy, history, even, dare I say, commerce.
Oh.
I know. I think that is really important and something that... in Australia, perhaps through our space agency, we need to be doing. Whether or not that will happen is a different matter. But while we're sitting here with our glasses of water, I wish we had glasses of wine or something. Conjecturing wildly, that's probably what I'd like to see.
So do you want to see the space agency fund art?
Well, yeah. You know why?
I think so.
You know why? The Antarctic program funds art.
Does it?
Yeah. So they have a teacher program. So every year they will take a teacher to Antarctica. So just an ordinary run-of-the-mill teacher from Australia can apply and go to Antarctica and come back and share that knowledge. But they also have... Actually, the New Zealand program is way better at this. They have a writer's position... and they also have an artist position every year. And they will, you can apply, and they will take you down to Antarctica with them, and you can sit at a desk or hang out in Antarctica and do art and or write, write novels, write short stories, write poetry, whatever it is that it, you have to, you know, go through a process and you apply and so on. And it sounds very token, but in fact... The New Zealand Antarctic program is quite small. And the amount of money required to get someone from New Zealand to Antarctica and keep them alive
yeah.
for a period of time is significant.
Oh, man.
So it's actually huge. Yeah, so I absolutely think we should be doing that with the Australian Space Agency. Mm. And, you know, if I might reverse my position on the humanity star, I would say from that perspective, while perhaps there should have been some more consultation with scientific communities and bodies, in essence, art is supposed to challenge and supposed to shock. And consultation may have resulted in it never being launched. And in fact, no harm was done.
No,
it was done responsibly. It fell out of the sky within 2 months. It provoked a lot of conversation. Who am I to say it was not art? What is art?
I think if it was publicly funded to be art, I'd like it.
Really?
Yeah.
But because it was privately funded, you don't like it?
I think the difference...
It was publicly supported.
Not sure quite how to respond.
I'm watching, for the benefit of listeners, Ben is sort of... I'm watching him struggle internally as things sort of come into conflict.
I think you've brought me to a point of, you know, aporia in this particular elenchus. but maybe what I mean is, if it could have been any art, if there were... some way that the enormous public expense of this were to be brought to be something that maybe came down to the decision of one artist, which was intended to be some intellectual or aesthetic response to space. If this were intended to be a contribution to culture, then yes, it seemed like a marketing exercise. And that's why it's not art.
Mm.
They were talking about this is, you know, it was all branded and they had a website which was all glitzy and they did all this press and it came out of nowhere and it wasn't very interesting. It wasn't very aesthetic, you know, it was just a little thing.
In your opinion?
In my opinion.
In my opinion, it was all right.
But
it wasn't arty enough.
It wasn't cool grassroots. Yeah, there should it lacked some kind of feeling of authenticity that I want real art to have.
But it's difficult, isn't it? Because if you want it to have authenticity,
and I also want it to be produced in an accountable way by a public organisation, I want the impossible, Annie.
And you want it to get into space with $30 million.
Maybe I don't have a good answer on the humanity star. Maybe my response is coloured by the community I come from and the way that this seemed to spit in its face. But I think doing something beautiful in space should be encouraged. Doing something beautiful about space might be even more encouraged, given that it doesn't cause any chaos for those of us who have to work with it. But I'm not sure.
All right. Well, it remains unsolved, but we might end it there. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you. This was very interesting.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Good.
And I enjoyed my bicky.
It was a good bicky. I had 2.
That's shocking.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
If anyone in the HPS department doesn't know where the bickies went, they went to me.
You've been listening to Space Junk. If you would like to find out more about space law or the history, philosophy, and sociology of science, you can follow me on Twitter at @ahandmer. That's A for Annie, H-A-N-D-M-E-R. You can also follow Dr. Ben Pope on @fringetracker. That's FRINGETRACKER. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.